This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2019, held on March 22 and 23, 2019, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Was said, I teach history and I teach Bible and theology. I haven't had a whole lot of experience with evangelism. I've done some of personal evangelism, obviously, and I also worked with two different evangelistic organizations in Germany for one time for about 5 months and one time for about 5 weeks in the summer. So what I'm going to be talking about mostly is a historical thing. What did the early church do? Some of you may be here just because of that, for the interest of historical interest. What did the church do? So I suspect at least some of you are here because you want some ideas about what to do. And there was an earlier talk that was really good, and I'm just going to tell you, if you're looking for some advice on that, the talk on the first day that Alan Roth gave on incorporating people from a different background is really good. So I sat in on that, and it's a very good talk. But anyway, as we think about how the early church evangelized in its first 300 years, an important thing for us to do is get a sense of what the place was like. The church arises in the Roman Empire. So what was the Roman Empire like? I think this is important even for us today because the setting that you're in probably will give some direction to how you ought to approach evangelism. So we're thinking about from Pentecost, A.D. 30, until about A.D. 330, thinking about that time period. And during that time period, the church was persecuted in the Roman Empire. So that is going to affect how they did their evangelism. I think, too, we should remember that God is sovereign. And it says in Galatians 4:4 that when the fullness of time had arrived, that God sent his son. And that means more than just when the Jewish people were ready. Now, that is very key. God had spent literally more than 1,000 years getting the Jewish people ready so that the Messiah could come. But I think it's also talking about the setting of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire would have had, of course, the Jewish culture as an influence, but also the Roman and the Greek cultures were influences. What can you tell me about the Roman Empire? What were some of the things that were true about it that might affect how people did evangelism? I'd like to hear from you.
There was a good infrastructure. Roads?
They had a good infrastructure. Roads, and something that fits with that, that sometimes people forget, the Romans had swept aside all of the pirates. So not only were the roads good, but the seas were good. You could travel very easily and very safely all throughout the Roman Empire. That's very good. And I heard some others. I don't know who. What, did you have something to say?
Like how the social structure worked in the Roman Empire, I've heard, is they cared very much about honor. Honor was very central to
mm-hmm.
of who was on top and who was on bottom, things like that.
Okay, that's true. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Yes?
Also a time of relative peace in the known world,
mm-hmm.
so that there weren't major disruptions.
Yes, and that's very important. There were 200 years called the Roman Peace, and that meant that it was, at least that side of it, made it easy for the people to travel around and talk about Jesus. Now, don't forget, there is persecution. It's not really extremely bad until the 200s and then the early 300s, late 200s and early 300s. But that's always something that Christians had to think about. I'll give you, does anybody else have anything else on the Roman Empire?
Common language.
Good. Common language. Latin was spoken all throughout the western part of the Roman Empire and probably pretty well understood in the eastern part of the empire. And that's going to make it a lot easier for people to spread this good news. Now, I want to tell you something about the early Christians. They always translated the Bible, at least into major languages, as they went to other places. In the Middle Ages, Christians didn't do that. They just had the Bible in the Latin, and then they required people to learn Latin, to read the Bible, and to have worship. So the early Christians, that was one of the things they did. They made sure that the Bible was in the language of the people, or at least the major languages of the people. Anything else on the Roman side? How about this side? I don't think anybody said anything over here. They were a powerful and influential government. And one thing about them that still comes through to this day is they had a very good legal system. And now, it only really helped Roman citizens, and at least at the beginning of this time period, only about 10% of the people were Roman citizens. But that legal system to this day affects us. Okay, I think that's pretty good. How about the Greeks? What did the Greeks contribute? And one of the things I want us to be thinking about is we live in a very different world. But think about wherever you are interested in going or wherever you are, what's there? And how is it going to affect how you present the gospel? So what about the Greek world?
Philosophy.
This is the early Christians, by and large, there was a little bit of disagreement on this point. But by and large, they took this philosophy that the Greeks had developed as, in essence, just a sharp way of thinking, a really good way of thinking. And they used that to present the gospel, to tell others about Christianity in an organized way. Okay, so Greek philosophy was very important. What else?
Kind of related to that, but they stressed the importance of learning and understanding.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The Greeks would have stressed the importance of learning. So they had a good educational system. And I have at least one more. One more.
Mythology.
Pardon?
Mythology.
Okay, now yes. I guess I'll say a little bit of something about that. I don't know how it's going to affect you where you're at, but some of the early Christians could actually point to the pagan mythology. I don't know if you're thinking about this. And they would say, this offers a hope here, and Jesus is the reality of that hope. Is that what you were thinking about? Yes. They did that. Now, they had to do it very carefully, but perhaps it gives you a little bit of an insight. How do these people think? What is their religion? Is there maybe either something very dark or something that shines some light in their religion that you can grab hold of and say, this is how Jesus relates to that? So that's I wasn't going to say anything about that, but that is true. I was thinking about language. This was also a widespread language. It's the language that the New Testament was written in, so that was important. As far as paganism in general, many historians would say that there was a flagging interest in the old belief in many, many gods, and that there was a yearning for something more personal and better. So it seems like there was a condition in the atmosphere where people were looking for something more than what their natural paganistic religion taught. And the pagan religion was not ethical. Now, these people are like any other people. They wanted ethics. They wanted to know how to live their life. Usually they looked, if they were just pagan, they would look to philosophy to see how to live. So what they did with their paganism was try to make sure that the gods were on their side. In other words, they tried to manipulate them. And when they wanted to know how to live, they looked at philosophy. Some of them, though, were very drawn to Christianity because it and Judaism were the only two religions that said God cares how you live and you don't manipulate him. In fact, you surrender to him and he shapes you. That's not what the pagans did. They tried to control the gods for their own. And, you know, you can just sense how that could be very frustrating and not fulfilling. And then the Jews, I just already mentioned they brought their ethical stance was appealing. They said God really cares about how you live. The monotheism was starting to make a lot of sense, that there really is only one God who has made this world. There's so much consistency in the world that it would seem to be a logical conclusion. The religious law the Jews had emphasized and upheld human dignity way better than, you know, the Roman law upheld human dignity, but only for those who were citizens. The Jewish law said that God cares about all of us. There's some passages in the Torah that say, you used to be slaves. Don't forget about that. And if you own a slave, you treat him well. You know, remember, this is where you were. So human dignity was an important thing in the Jewish religion. And there was an awareness that there's going to be an eventual restoration and justice for all. Everyone recognized the world is a mess. There's something wrong. And for the Christians and the Jews, they knew that somehow at the beginning, everything had been perfect, had been created perfect, but man had somehow messed it up. I don't know that the Jews say it exactly the way the Christians do. We point to Adam and Eve. I haven't talked to a Jew about that, how they see that, but something changed. But God was in process of bringing us a restoration. And so all of these things appealed very strongly to a pagan who was looking for something that was more consistent, deeper, that was personal. And that was, it seems at least, that was the situation in the first century A.D. Well, into this setting, like I said, Galatians 4:4 says that at the proper time, God sent his son. And I think that all of these things were part of that being the proper time. And, you know, when you come into another field, I think that's God's proper time. But the thing to do then is to think about, so how do all of these cultural things in that setting, how do they affect how I am going to do my witnessing? Well, the church grew on Pentecost Day from about 120 people before Peter gave his sermon to about 3,000 people Peter gave his sermon. And we're told that every day the church continued to grow, and Peter and John were arrested a short time after the church had gotten started when they healed that lame man. And it doesn't, it's a little bit unclear to me, but it either is saying in that passage that there were 5,000 people total by that point, or 5,000 more were won over. And I'm not quite sure which it's saying. It's not 100% clear. But within days after Pentecost, we're up to 5,000. That's for sure. At least 5,000. When Jesus ascended into heaven in Acts 1:8, he says that I want you to go and tell this message. And he gives it in an order. And the order is meaningful. Give it at home first, Jerusalem and Judea, and then go to Samaria, that place that's a lot like where you come from, and then eventually go out into the whole Gentile world. And that is exactly the movement that we see. Pentecost happens at Jerusalem, and the church very quickly spreads throughout Judea. And then finally, it goes up into Samaria. And that was a big jump for these people. The Jews did not like the Samaritans. And it looks like God worked things out very specially so that they had to see that this is God at work with the Samaritans. They also didn't like the Gentiles very much. That's us. And God really had to work on them for this one. He had to prepare Peter to be open to the fact that God loves everyone. You know, the Old Testament says this. The Old Testament says that all the Gentiles are going to be brought into the church, but it doesn't tell you how. So let's not be too hard on Peter. He knew that this was supposed to happen. And even the Jews who are Judaizers, they know their scriptures. Their scriptures said that all the people in the world are eventually going, the God's people are going to include people from all over the world. But what's that going to look like? The Old Testament doesn't tell us. And God had to really work hard with Peter so that he was able to do what it took. God showed him that we're not to call unclean what God has said is clean. And so finally, you're supposed to go with these men. He tells them before they ever show up. And so Peter does this and ends up in the household of Cornelius, who was a Gentile, and a Roman military officer, neither one of which would Peter have liked. He was a Gentile, and the Jews were afraid to go into a Gentile house because it might, it wouldn't necessarily make you unclean, but it might, depending on what the Gentile had done. But then, too, he's a Roman military officer, and the Jews despised being under the rule of Rome. So it's a double whammy here. But Peter listens to God and finally opens the gospel up to everyone. It's been open to the Jews, been open to the Samaritans, and now to the ones who are the most different from the Jews. That's everyone else, essentially, Gentiles. Well, much of the early success of the church was based on the fact that these Gentiles had heard the Old Testament. If you read carefully, well, Cornelius was. Does anybody know what kind of a believer he was? Depending on your translation, it may or may not make this clear. Okay, a proselyte is a person who fully joins the Jewish religion. So he gets circumcised and he follows the food laws. And Cornelius wasn't doing that. So the highest level for a Gentile would be to become a proselyte, because in essence he's become a Jew. He knows the law, he's going to follow it, he gets circumcised and he does the food laws. Cornelius wasn't circumcised and he wasn't practicing the food laws, but he was a worshiper of Yahweh. He went to the synagogue. What do you call that other level? That's a little bit lower. God-fearing. Yeah, God-fearing. And I really think that's part of the reason that the church spread so quickly. In Acts 15:21, when they're trying to decide what should we do, what should we require of the Gentiles, they come up with a list of four things, which you can look at. But one of the interesting things that it says there is that Moses has been preached in every city from the earliest times and is read in the synagogues on every Sabbath. He's talking about all the cities of the Roman Empire, and essentially the Jews have been scattered throughout the whole of the Roman Empire. They've got synagogues everywhere, and there are a lot of people who hear the Old Testament. And so those that do and that respond to it either become proselytes — a lot fewer became proselytes — or they became God-fearers. Many of the Gentiles became God-fearers. And so they were already primed. They knew the Old Testament. They knew that there was but one God, and that eventually he wanted to bring the Gentiles in, however this was going to happen. And so I think this is a key thing. You're going to find in different places, you're going to find some people who have been primed for the gospel. And so these were the people, the majority of the people who first came into the church, people who were primed. They were either God-fearers, or they were proselytes, or they were Jews. Now, but over time, that group of people is going to be exhausted. I mean, in other words, they're all going to come into the church. And then what happens? Then you have a setting where most of the people are pagan, and they have a pagan mindset. They haven't been shaped like the proselyte and the God-fearer by God's word. Those people would go to synagogue. They heard God's word. It started to shape them. They had a sense of true ethics. They knew the promise that God had for them. But now, after those people come into the church, you're going to have something a little bit different. You're going to have people who don't have an awareness of what the Jewish mindset is. And that's going to cause a difference in how the church works. But anyway, so and it's not just a mindset either. It's about a lifestyle. The church felt that how you lived and what you thought, both things were very important. From Pentecost, which is about AD 30, And for the next 300 years, the church spread from Jerusalem throughout the whole of the Roman Empire and even way outside of the Roman Empire. It went into Persia, it went into Ethiopia, especially spreading to the south and to the east. Not so much to the north at this point anyway. By the time we get to the year 300 or so, the Roman Empire has some provinces in the eastern part of the empire that are majority Christian. So this would be places like what we call Turkey, Syria, Egypt, those areas today. Back in the year 300 or so, at least large swaths of those provinces were majority Christian, probably roughly 50% or just a little bit more. When you get to the western part of the empire, it's not quite as heavily Christianized. Probably people that have tried to figure these things out, you can actually make some good guesses by looking at how many artifacts you find that seem to be Christian, etc. You can make some good good estimates. And so it's been thought that between a quarter to a third of the population of the Roman Empire in the, let's say, by about 330, the time that Constantine is emperor, and he's the first emperor to call himself a Christian, by that time they're about a third to a quarter, somewhere in there. I should start with a quarter to a third of the population may have been Christianized. How did this happen? Well, of course, the Spirit is key here. But when I look at history, I can't always be sure, you know, how to say this is the Spirit or this isn't. But anyway, so what I'm going to do is look at what can we evaluate from history. I believe the Spirit was at work in these things. And what contributed to the quick growth of Christianity in the Roman Empire? During most of the time we're looking at, the state was hostile to Christianity. That doesn't mean they were actively persecuting them all the time. In fact, there are really only three major church empire-wide persecutions, and those are towards the end of this time period. There are other times when locally there'd be persecution, and that's one thing the Christians were aware of, or the people who were drawn to the church. One of the things they were aware of was they heard that the Christians in Syria are being persecuted. So you might live in Gaul and be perfectly safe, but you heard about persecution in Syria. Gaul had a very harsh persecution around the year 170. And so the Syrians might be hearing that the Christians in Gaul are being persecuted now. But until you get to about 250, you don't have a persecution that's empire-wide. It's only in 250 when you first have that. However, the state tended to be hostile towards Christians. And the Jews also were hostile. And you see this all throughout the New Testament, in Paul's letter, a little bit in Paul's letters. In the book of Acts, you see it, how the Jews would try to cause trouble for the Christians as they gained converts. Except for people like Paul, there were really very few. Except for Paul and it looks like the apostles. It looks like there were very few organized missionary efforts. Paul, of course, we know his efforts. They're pretty well recorded in Acts and also in his epistles. It doesn't tell us, but he planned on going to Spain. I personally think that there are some evidences outside of the New Testament that point to the probability that he actually did get to Spain and then came back to Rome where he was executed. That's a supposition. We can't prove it for sure, but that was his plan, and I think it actually happened. The other apostles were given places to go to and start the church in those places. And other than that, we really don't have a whole lot of information about someone was sent out and that a church actually sent him, like the Antioch church. And Paul says to the Romans, I want you to send me to Spain. We don't have a lot of that. There are a few other instances, but it's very rare. One of the interesting stories about one of the apostles is that Thomas was chosen to go to India. And that has been scoffed at by many scholars until relatively recently. In the early 1900s, Well, first of all, I should tell you that the story tells us that he went to India, met a king with a certain name, and eventually converted him. And then he eventually was martyred. The interesting thing is that most scholars up until the early 1900s would have scoffed at that and said, that couldn't have happened. It's an impossibility. The Romans didn't know how to get to India except going through Persia, so I don't think that happened. Well, it's very interesting. If Thomas did go to India, he would have gone probably sometime around the year AD 50. And it's right around the year AD 50 that the Romans figured out how to use the monsoon winds to go straight to India and to come back, avoiding going along the coast, which was enemy territory, Persia. Persia and Rome were not friends. So right around AD 50, they found this out. And, the skeptics also scoffed at the name of the king, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but that's not important. The legend says that a king so-and-so is the one that Thomas talked to first. Well, in 1920 or so, there was an archaeological dig in India, and it's the first evidence of a king with that particular name. And the coins point to the right time period, roughly AD 50. This is not proof. This is just something very interesting, I think, anyway. And so I do think that this is probably something that happened, that Thomas went there and established a church. We know there's a church there very early. We don't know, unless Thomas brought it there, we don't know how it got there. It's just the first time we read about it, we hear that it's kind of weak, and the Christians in what we call Iraq today would send help to this church to keep it going. So, but other than that, they don't say where it started, except they would have accepted that Thomas had started it. But my main point is, in the early years, the church didn't say, or any individual church say, let's get a mission organization started and send out people to certain places. It didn't happen. What happened mostly was self-chosen traveling evangelists. People just seemed to decide, and I think the Spirit was leading them, that I'm going to sell my stuff and I'm going to go out and I'm going to preach. We actually have some, in the New Testament, we have some places that indicate this. 2 and 3 John talk about these traveling preachers, and that you need to be sure that they're teaching the truth. This is one of the first places that we have an awareness that some doctrinal some bad doctrinal ideas are sneaking in. And the particular problem... what was the particular problem that they needed to watch for? So here we are in Lancaster, and there's a traveling preacher that comes. What are we supposed to watch for? At least one thing is mentioned.
The deity of Jesus?
That wasn't what they questioned. They accepted the deity of Jesus. There is a question of that later, but you're getting really close.
The humanity
of Jesus. If you don't believe that Jesus came as one of us, it says you're of the Antichrist. Now, that's pretty important. And so the early Christians were concerned both about lifestyle, ethics, and about what they believed. And so this is really important here. That they teach the right thing. And I think all of us would agree that we don't want to be of the Antichrist. There, Revelation 2, verse 2, may also be dealing with traveling, self-chosen evangelists. This is where the letter is written to Ephesians or Ephesus, the church at Ephesus, and it says that I commend you because you really check out those people who say they're apostles, but they teach the wrong thing. So that may be the same thing. I don't think it's talking about the 12 apostles, but those who are traveling around and talking, the Ephesian church will probably welcomed in ones that taught well, but they made sure that was the case, that they were actually teaching the truth. So they were concerned about how the people lived and what they taught. The earliest writing outside of the scriptures, the earliest Christian writing outside of the scriptures, outside of the New Testament, is a writing called the Didache, and it's probably from before 100. It's probably from before 100. And it's very interesting. Oh, and it goes by another. If you see the teaching of the 12 apostles, that's the Didache. So the Didache is a Greek word meaning teaching, and the full title in English would be Teaching of the 12 Apostles. It also mentions traveling evangelists and preachers who had chosen to do this themselves. And there are several other church leaders in the 200s and 300s who write about this. So that seems to be the key way that the word was spread, maybe into a new area, that some people decided that they're called by the Spirit and they would sell their stuff and they would go into a new area and talk to the people about Jesus. They also obviously visited churches along the way and spoke to them. Eusebius mentions this too. He would write in the 300s. Now, just outside of our period is the first time we really get a lot of organized, the church is organizing and sending, choosing people and sending them out. But it's not during those first 300 years. Just after 300 years, the church is more mature and it's starting to pick people and send them out. And this is the time when people like, you've all heard of Patrick in Ireland. This is, he's in the 400s. And he senses a call from God, but the church also ordains him a bishop and sends him back to Ireland. And so the kind of thing that we're a little more used to happens just right outside of this time period. Okay, so traveling evangelists were very important, especially for bringing the word into areas where it hadn't been heard yet. But probably the major way that the church grew was through personal encounter. And this just doesn't mean just that I live near a Christian and I see how he lives, so I go and I ask him about that. I'll talk a little bit more about what that involves. It involved a Christian lifestyle. It involved the things they said that surprised people. You know, if I was a Christian merchant and I didn't cheat you and I had the chance to do that, and then others were cheating their customers, those customers would notice this and they'd say, "What is this?" And, of course, they'd also hear you talk about Jesus. They'd hear you talk about your faith. And this is the key thing. How the Christians that the pagans rubbed shoulders with, that was the key thing as far as growth of Christianity. But it wasn't just how they lived. All of the writings mention miracles, healings, and exorcisms. And so these people, these pagans, would come to the Christians with their problems, and the Christians would pray for them, and things happened. But it was still very personal. It's still very much one-on-one. But this is mentioned over and over again. And even in the Talmud. The Talmud was written, was put together about 500, and it's written during a time when the Jews and the Christians were competing for converts. And also, the Christians were looking to Jews to become Christians because the Messiah had come. So there's a very polemical or very negative set of writings in the Talmud about this Jesus. But the interesting thing is, one of the things they say is, yes, he did miracles, he did healings, and the Christians do too, and exorcisms, but it's from the devil. So it's very interesting whenever you have your enemy or your opponent say, yes, these things happened, but the reason is because the wrong power was being called upon. So even Judaism that was in opposition to Christianity would have said that these things really were happening. So it's not just the Christians saying that they were happening, some of the pagans would recognize it, and the Jews would recognize it. Another issue was what Alan Kreider, he's a Mennonite writer, calls the patient lifestyle of the Christians. And I really like this book. I'm going to tell you at the end about the book, and I think it's a good one for you to read and to think about. But anyway, the patient lifestyle of the Christians really influenced many people to accept Christianity. Up until the time of Constantine, now that's the end of our time period. Things changed then, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But up until that time, all of the Christian writers make a a deal about patience. This is not a pagan virtue. The pagans said that the people who should be patient are whom? Who should be patient? Who's the average pagan going to say should be in the Roman Empire?
Slaves.
Slaves should be patient. This is not a high value virtue for the average Roman, and yet this lifestyle that the Christians said it's the virtue from which all the other virtues come. They said that it shows God's character, that he's patient with us. And I just say, amen, and thank the good Lord for that. I sure need his patience. And it said that his patience is obvious in the incarnation. Think about that. To be God and to lay aside for a while some of your powers. This is in Philippians 2. You just think about this. Laying that aside and coming down here for us and then dying for us. And, you know, he is life. Jesus, God is life. And so his dying isn't like thinking about our dying. I don't want to die. None of you want to die. But think about it. If you were actually life, what would it be to lay that down? It's incredible what that would mean. So life himself came down here, became one of us, experienced life the way we do, lived it perfectly, and then laid his life down. I don't know the words for that. But anyway, the Christians looked to that and they said, this is a proof that God wants us to live that way. He's our model. And I think in the modern world, this is a valuable thing to be thinking about. The modern world values success and efficiency and all kinds of things. But taking time to be relational with somebody is not one of the great things that the modern world values. And so I think here's a place for us to learn something from, even if you disagree with other things, this is a place to learn from the early church and how they approach things. The early church also said that bodily habits were important. And I could point to 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul says that he pummels his body to keep it under so that he doesn't. What we do, how we live our lives physically, is important. And it's what the pagans are going to see. And it's also just important because we are meant to be both physical and spiritual. Paul talks about putting things off and putting other things on, which is about, at least in part, about how you live, the habits you develop. Ephesians 5 from verse 8 to 6 verse 8 and Colossians 3 verse 12 to 4 verse 6 are some very interesting passages. You read them and you're going to say, ho-hum, of course we ought to live this way. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, obey your husbands. Masters, don't be mean to your slaves. Slaves, obey your masters. Fathers, don't get your children all upset. And children, obey your parents. Okay, it sounds so obvious. This is not the Roman world. This was not the way pagans thought. Who mattered in the pagan world? One guy mattered. One kind of guy mattered. Who mattered?
The emperor?
Well, the emperor. But I'm talking now more like, okay, so here we are in Lancaster City. And who are the people?
The citizens.
The citizens mattered, but...
Me.
Huh?
Me.
Are you a dad?
Yes.
Good. Dads mattered. And everybody else had to listen to them. He had his wife's and his children's and his slaves' lives in his hand. And the state wouldn't do anything about it. If he said, you're out, you're out. Okay, that's the setting. This sounds so obvious to us. And Christians have actually affected the world, even where the world isn't Christian. Most of the world kind of agrees with this. They didn't back then. And so when they read this, they were hearing something hugely countercultural, that everybody matters. And it wasn't the natural way for a Roman to think. And we're getting close to the end, so I'm going to go really into one of the key things that I think is important. So I've tried to make it clear that as time went on, there were fewer and fewer proselytes and God-fearers and Jews who were coming into the church. Most of them had already come in that were going to. And now pagans are coming into the church. And they have a very different mindset than what those proselytes would have had. They have a typical pagan mindset. And we don't know exactly when. There's some clues that it might be around the year 100. But the church starts requiring what we would call catechesis, or what we sometimes call instruction class. And they realize they were bringing people into the church whose minds... The story of Jesus appeals to lots of people. You hear this story that somehow this God came down and he died for me, and now I'm saved. I'm released from the problems I have, whatever they are, however you can conceive of that. That sounds really neat, but that doesn't mean your mind, your way of thinking has changed. Your worldview has changed. And over time, I believe that the church started recognizing we are having difficulties because people are coming in who like the story but don't get it, don't understand all of it. And so that little passage in 2nd and 3rd John about being careful about Gnostics is there were people coming in who loved that story, or at least as much of it as, you know, the part of the story about this God coming and dying for me. That's wonderful. But then they didn't understand that God had made this world and made a good world, that he is redeeming. They wanted to get out of this world. Now, I can't get into too much. I only have 5 minutes. But it's clear that over time, the church starts to require catechesis instruction class. And sometimes it could go as long as 3 years. They didn't have an absolute number or a period of time. And what they did during that time was make sure you don't just like this Jesus. There's more than one Jesus. Did you know that? And put this down to look up later. But in 2 Corinthians 11, it says there's more than one Jesus, there's more than one Spirit, there's more than one gospel. And the church started to experience that, and they started doing something to make sure that people understood who this Jesus is and what it means, both in your habits, how you live, and just the whole array, how you think, how you live. And during this time of catechesis, they made sure that they understood that God made this world. There's one God. He made this world. He made it good. It's fallen, but one of the things Jesus is doing is he came to save us spiritually at this point. He's coming back again to restore the earth. Read Peter's, I can't remember if it's the first or second gospel, sermon in Acts, but he talks about the restoration of all things. And in Romans 7, it talks about the whole universe groaning under bondage. And it's not groaning to be destroyed. It's groaning to be redeemed. And so the Christians were fighting with a pagan mindset that rejected all of that. We have a lot of that today, I think, in our own setting. But as you go out to places, that may be one of the things you have to think about. I'm going to suggest that some kind of time period, some kind of process to help people really understand who this Jesus is. There's more than one Jesus. Who is this Jesus? They are probably being drawn by the Spirit, but I think that the early church chose to start catechizing their people before they baptized them. They did recognize they were in a different setting once they had chosen to go that far, but they weren't fully Christian until they were baptized. I think that we at least can learn something from this. And I'll go really quickly. The catechesis back then included emphasis on transforming your habits, avoidance of idolatry, and... You know, for us, we need to learn about that. We have idols that we hardly recognize. We don't make stone idols anymore, but we have idols. So anyway, avoidance of idolatry in all its forms. Mastery of the biblical story. At least understand God made this. It was perfect. We fell. And then God worked with this Jewish people to bring the Messiah. And now we get the benefit of that. emphasized the teachings of Jesus. They encouraged memorization, and often this was by rote. These people didn't read often, so they would hear verses, and they were encouraged to memorize them. Mentoring. When you chose to come into a the way you came into a catechetical class was you talked to your neighbor. What's this about Jesus, and why do you treat me the way you do? And then he would go to if he felt you were really seeking, he'd take you to the bishop, and you would go, the bishop would decide, let's bring him into this class. And then that man who brought him to the bishop was supposed to, he was called a patron, and he was supposed to keep up with him. Is he changing, and how he can change more and better? So mentoring was a big part of it. Distinctive Christian values that they emphasized the distinctive Christian values that contradicted pagan thinking. They acted out what their candidates learned, so how to pray and how to give. They actually sent them out to give some of their own money, which was not a normal pagan thing to do. And then practical issues that the candidate would encounter. I'll stop there because I'm just about out of time. But I will tell you, if that idea intrigues you at all, even if you don't like it, maybe you should read this book called The Patient Ferment of the Early Church by Alan Kreider. I think it gives some very good insight that can help us as we think about the setting we're in, what kinds of things we ought to do. You know, I'm not giving you an exact pattern, but I'm just saying that really helping a person break through his pagan thinking. I think we even have pagan thinking in the church, children that we raise and all. But anyway, breaking through that pagan thinking and acting, this can give you some good ways of thinking about that. So I was going to ask for questions, but this man is telling me I have to sit down.
Can you read the title of that book?
The Patient Ferment of the Early Church by Alan Kreider, and his name is Kreider.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.